This, for me, is what our community is all about. You know, it's about people picking up the gauntlet. You know, in the anti-fracking community, right from the get-go, you know, we got really frustrated with people saying, oh, have you thought of, have you done, what about doing this? And in the end, we said, whoa. You know, we've got advice coming out the proverbial yin-yang. What we need is people to say, I am doing, I have done, look at this. You know, it's changing the vocabulary. Changing the vocabulary from passing the buck to actually taking responsibility. And I mean, this is really what Dave and Lynn and everyone else that was associated with them have done. They've picked up the gauntlet and they've run with it. You know, it's not a case of, oh, wouldn't it be great if somebody developed GCMF or somebody developed an effective treatment for cancer. They got after it. Yeah, I mean, it has to be said that, because I hadn't made the observation previously, during the course of the hearing, the judge turned to David and he said, so, knowing what you know now, Mr. Noakes, would you continue to break the law? And almost without hesitation, David said, is it worth breaking the law to save lives? Absolutely it is. And whilst the prosecution tried to make a meal of that on the basis that it just showed David's contempt for the law, it wasn't lost on the judge, and it certainly wasn't lost on the people in the public gallery, that here was a man, you know, who actually had the courage of his conviction and wasn't going to balk from that responsibility. And neither did David balk from the responsibility of accepting that for everything that had occurred, ultimately he was responsible. And the prosecution were obviously trying to get him to pass the buck. And, you know, a couple of times, obviously, he made the observation. He said, well, I'm not a scientist, so I am reliant on my scientists. And they said, ah, so you're passing the buck. He said, no, but I was employing people who knew what they were doing. It was their subject, it was their speciality, and I took their advice, as would any CEO. And, you know, once again, obviously, you know, when you're in the court of law, then, you know, the Crown Prosecution Service have a job to do. And I got to say that Angela Jones, I think it was, the QC, who was working on behalf of the MHRA, she looked to me to be very, very uncomfortable. I mean, she was a bitch, don't get me wrong. We might have to delete that. I mean, she was a bitch, but she could have been a much worse bitch. And I was watching her very closely. And when she was just behaving normally, then, you know, she was actually quite relaxed, chatty. When she was putting David under cross-examination, her hands were seriously shaking. And I got the impression that she was very, very uncomfortable. And once again, this is the importance of the mutual support. And, you know, having that packed public gallery every day, and there were actually another set of seats across the other side of the courtroom, which the judge fortunately opened up to any overflow from the public gallery. And, you know, this is really important because it serves to keep the judge, dare I say, I won't say honest, but, you know, it absolutely serves to make sure that they are kept on track because they know they will be held to account. And, you know, obviously David's sentence is outrageous. It's excessive. But let me tell you, the Crown Prosecution Service and the MHRA are seriously pissed off. And hopefully this will serve Lynn as well because Lynn is still, unfortunately, under threat of extradition. So once we know when that extradition hearing is going to be heard, which it's likely to be in Westminster, I believe. In the High Court. Okay, well, perfect. I'm very familiar with the High Court. So if it's in the High Court, then I hope that once we get the word out there that the hearing is scheduled to take place, that there will be a lot of support fall in because we, you know, don't expect anything to be out there in the mainstream media other than the crap that Dr. Salaya asks and works, you know, puts out there. You know, the important thing is that we are there, there's a physical presence, and they know that we are sharing that word. And You know, the BBC guy, Robert Burns, and I said to him at the start of the week, I said, somehow I doubt that you're going to let the facts get in the way of your reporting this week. And he said, well, we're a very respected news agency. And I said, and no doubt you're a legend in your own lunchtime. No, he was definitely looking at it through a completely different lens. And, I mean, I made a similar observation to him at the end of the week. But what was interesting, on the one day that I couldn't make it to court, which was the Monday, the judge actually put reporting restrictions on, because, he knew that the only output was going to be the BBC, and he actually put reporting restrictions on and actually made the observation that he wasn't very happy with the reporting for the week, didn't he? And I don't know whether I mentioned this earlier, but it was very obvious to me that the judge was watching my morning live streams, because I think it was on the Tuesday, or the Wednesday, but the Tuesday, which is the second day, he repeated a phrase which was verbatim what I'd said in the morning live stream. So, no, at the time, I thought, oh, that's coincidental. But then he did it exactly the same the following day, and I thought, okay, you know, he's giving me the message that... So after that, I made the point, and if you watch my live streams on, I think, the Friday and the Monday and Tuesday, I say, and Justice Nicholas Smith is very even-handed in his... Hey, got to play the game, huh? So anyway, obviously, look, David is only allowed 2 visits a month, and really, obviously, they have to be for family, but obviously, he can receive mail. And this is the important thing, because every letter that's written is read by the establishment. So here's a great opportunity. Let's make sure that David has the biggest mailbag in Wandsworth Prison. And because it's the time of year, if you don't have the time, and I appreciate people are under pressure on time, if you don't have the time, send him a Christmas card and put the message in the Christmas card. Now, the address is on my YouTube channel and on my Facebook pages. So if you look there, then you will see the address. And here's a bit of advice that I received from somebody who has the experience, and that is that put the name and the prison number, not just on the envelope, but also on the letter as well, because apparently the envelopes will get lost. And then, we don't know who this is for, so it just gets binned. So to make sure it gets to David, put his name and the prisoner number on the actual letter as well. And hopefully David will be out in 4 months, we hope, and then he'll be tagged for 4 months. But knowing David as little as I do, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, Lynn, but I got a feeling that this ain't the end of GC Math in David's life. I mean, obviously, the people that were coming along to the court were outside the court. But funnily enough, when the BBC were there, they weren't actually taking pictures or film footage of the supporters outside. But you're right. I mean, there's no question that, don't necessarily expect the BBC to put it out there, but the alternative media will. You know, so one way or another, the numbers are important.
Brian says,
hang on.
Brian says, if the BBC don't cover it, if we put a crowd outside the High Court, then we move the crowd to the BBC office.
There you go. Absolutely. So, obviously a lot of people are asking. I mean, I tell you, over the last sort of 2 weeks or so, the number of emails I've received saying, where can you get GC Math? And of course, it's people I've never heard of, and it's like, oh, yeah. You know, so we have to be very, very careful in the response to this. And so at the moment, I'm not responding to any of those blatant requests. I mean, unfortunately, I have to simply ask people to do their own research and, see what they can find for themselves until such time as we get through this particular period. You know, it's not even just in this country. There's a former colleague of Lynn's who Lynn, I believe, is prevented from contacting. He's certainly prevented from contacting anybody in this country. So he is under effective house arrest in France, pending a trial in France. So, this is the persecution. And so this is, what we have to get out there. So I'm going to bring that element to a close and just say, Lynn, really, you guys have been truly amazing. And I take my hat off to you guys. What we are looking at is, you know, we are on the cusp, and we've been on the cusp for some time, but we're on the cusp of something very significant. And which way this goes is absolutely going to be down to what I'm going to refer to as Middle England. Middle England. You know, whether we like to admit it or not, the reality is that no social change at any time in history has ever occurred until the middle classes actually start to realize that unless they get involved, then their hard worked for gains are at risk of being taken away. And it doesn't matter where you go in history, over the last 6,000 years, it's only when the middle classes actually start to take an interest. You know, the working classes are ready for change anytime, because there's a significant chunk of them that are downtrodden, kept in poverty. But I'm not going to get into the whys and the wherefores, but unfortunately, even if they do rise, just ask Wat Tyler, you know, even if they do rise, it never has the legs because they don't have the support of Middle England. And if you haven't got the support of Middle England, then what Middle England does when they rise is just go, oh, I don't want to go there. And an illustration of that is what happened in 1979, which is very, very significant because that's the turning point that started to get us into this mess. How many people here remember the Winter of Discontent? Yeah. I got to say that I had absolute disdain for the trade unions in that point, in that period, because they had completely lost Middle England. You know, they whatever their motivation, but they had lost Middle England, and I believe that they were deliberately set up to bring about what was needed to get the corporatocracy back in full control. And they fell for it hook, line, and sinker. And so did I. Because as I've made the admission a number of times, I couldn't wait to vote for Margaret Thatcher back in 1979. If only I knew then. But hey, you know, I was 22, I think, at the time. And, you know, I was seeing what was occurring around the country, and I was experiencing firsthand, you know, some active trade unionism, which in my opinion was not in the best interests of their membership. And for me, at the time, the trade union movement needed a slap. Unfortunately, it got a lot more than that. And of course, then, the coup de grâce was the brilliant strategy of Arthur Scargill. And taking the miners out on strike in March, when the stockpiles of coal around the country were the highest they had ever been. Now, at the time, I was living in East Anglia, and there was a coal-fired power station on the banks of the River Orwell, just on the edge of Ipswich. And the Orwell Bridge, which was fairly recently opened at that point, the Orwell Bridge rose quite steeply over the River Orwell because it was ocean-going vessels that came up to Ipswich at that time. And the stockpile of coal was so enormous, it came way above the bridge. And I could see, you know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to work out what was occurring then. And by then I was, 27? So, you know, I was starting to get a better feel for the bigger picture at that time. So I knew that the intention here was to use the miners' strike, one, to destroy the coal mining industry in this country, because obviously North Sea oil was now effectively the main source of energy, so we no longer needed 282,000 members of the NUM, and we certainly didn't need their graft in the mines, so the rug was pulled from under them. And Arthur Scargill, wittingly or otherwise, facilitated that opportunity. And so the corporatocracy by the mid-80s was well and truly embedded. And of course, Hollywood serves its role, because anyone remember the key film that was released at that time to push this agenda?
Star Wars.
Hello. Sorry, are you with us? You're like the BBC journalist, you know, you're watching this through a completely different lens. Okay, there was another film, not Star Wars. It was called Wall Street. Wall Street. And of course, the mantra of Wall Street was greed is good. Greed is good. And then we had Harry Enfield offering the comic version of that with loads of money. And, you know, we think, oh, that's comedy. But this is all part of the influence, the mind control to create this perception that, you know, unless you're out there getting loads of money, then basically, you know, you're a waster and there's no point in you being around. And that's what's being driven. And this was when I was thinking about this event, I thought, you know, it's starting to become more and more obvious. And the articles are in the media telling people what's occurring. And then this one caught my attention. This was in The Guardian, and I think it was mid-November, so it was only about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And this was the graphic. This is the graphic that was with the article. But the headline was, "The Bad Behavior of the Richest, What I Learned from Wealth Managers." And this is a guy who worked in the city, obviously worked with the extremely wealthy in the country. And he said, "The habits of the wealthiest mirror the supposed pathologies of the poor. But while those in poverty are called lazy, the rich are dubbed bon vivants." Says, in nearly a decade, interviewing the wealth managers for the 1%, if it taught me anything, it's that the ultra-rich and the ultra-poor have a lot more in common than stereotypes might lead you to believe. In conversation, wealth managers kept coming back to the flamboyant vices of their clients. Well, we know what that means, don't we? It was quite unexpected, in the course of discussing tax avoidance, to hear professional service providers say things like, "I've told my colleagues, if I ever become like some of our clients, shoot me. Because they are really immoral people. Too much time on their hands and all the money means they have no limits. I was actually told by one client not to bring my wife on a trip to Monaco unless I wanted to see her get hit on by 10 guys. The local sport," he said, "was picking up other men's wives." Morality doesn't even come into play, of course. The clients of this Geneva-based wealth manager also believe that they are descended from the pharaohs. Now, anyone who's been following my work for the past decade plus will know that I have made the observation many, many times that those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of this planetary fiefdom actually believe themselves to be directly descended from the Nephilim. And the pharaohs, of course, are descended from the Nephilim, or many historians, orthodox and otherwise, believe that to be the case. So now, whether this is true or not doesn't actually matter. It's what they believe. And because it's what they believe, it gives it a life. And I'm not going to go into all the detail of the blood issues between the Nephilim and humanity. But if you want to see a synopsis of that, then look at the presentation that I made in 2006, in July 2006, called The Hidden Agenda. And it's where I actually outline the detail behind this observation. Now, what's that, 2006? So that's 12 years ago. 12 years ago, the likelihood of a comment like that, believe that they are descended from the pharaohs and they are destined to inherit the earth, would be dismissed as absolutely rampant barking conspiracy theory. But he goes on in the article, "If a poor person voiced such beliefs, he or she might well be institutionalized. For those who work with the wealthy, however, such eccentricities are all in a day's work. Indeed, an underappreciated irony of accelerating economic inequality has been the way it has exposed behaviours among the ultra-rich that mirror the supposed pathologies of the ultra-poor. But if you're at the wrong end of the scale, then obviously you are dismissed as a social miscreant. But if you're at the other end of the social scale, then it's normal, as Jeffrey Epstein has, of course, established. Well, let's have a look at the magnitude of the inequality, because this is actually, I think, from about 2015. But inequality is much higher amongst original incomes than disposable incomes, with the poorest 10% having an average of an original income of 4,436, whilst the top 10% have an original income 24 times larger. And look at this. So what we have seen over the past literally 30-odd years, let me say 40 years, since 79, so that's 39 years. What we've seen is the average CEO salary of a Fortune 500 company go from 40 times that of their average employee to well over 400. And here's the share of income earned by the top 1%. As you can see, it took a bit of a dip after the financial crash, particularly in the UK, which is this line here. But yeah, it's back on track now. So what we are seeing and have seen over 39 years, so, you know, we've got a fair bit of data to be able to work on here. What we are seeing is the trend for those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers identifying sociopaths amongst humanity to take advantage of those who are less able and treat them like absolute cattle. And this is not an accident. This has been well planned for, well prepared, well scripted, and what we're seeing now is the play out of that script. So where can you find that script? Well, you can find it in the book that I took the title of this event from, Democracy in Chains, by Nancy MacLean. And I don't have the time this afternoon, obviously, to take you through the detail of that book, but I'm going to share some of the insights in that book. But if you feel that you want to understand the deeper agenda behind what's occurring, then this book is the place to start. How many of you were at AV8.1 last year? Okay. Patrick Henningsen's presentation was titled something along the lines of media in the age of the digital plantation or something of those lines. It was the digital plantation. And what Patrick may or may not have realized was that there was some very, very significant truism in that observation, because the current philosophies being rolled out by the global corporatists is actually based on this. It's based on the mentality and the philosophy of those who ran the plantations. And that's exactly what we have. Just think about this as I unfold it over the next few minutes. So what we had is the branding. This is the plantation owning the slave. But notice that it's not the plantation owner that brands the slave. He wouldn't demean himself to do that. So he uses his management. The management. Who was that? That was the Hale and Pace, or was it the management? So you use the management to brand the slaves. And of course, that, you know, identifies that person. But what does that person get in return? Well, provided they graft every hour of daylight and subject themselves to whatever the whim of the plantation owner might be, then in return, they may have had a roof over their head and just about sufficient food to survive. This is the modern day version. But this is even, this is demonized in this country. This is the slave labor. in the Far East. And recently I was asked to participate in a survey by a good friend of mine. And he said, Ian, would you mind participating in a survey? Because my daughter is studying fashion in the UK and she wants to put out a survey to people. And I said, well, I'm not sure I know very much about fashion, but yeah, you know, why not? I said, but, you know, as long as she's prepared for some fairly honest answers. Anyway, one of the first questions was, would you buy a pair of expensive trainers if you knew that they were manufactured in a slave labor plant in China? And my response was, well, how does this differentiate between slave labor in the UK? Because here, the slave is at least guaranteed, we think, probably, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours of work a week and an income from that, which at least enables her to keep a roof over the head and, you know, have enough food to at least be able to come to work every day. In this country, we define, it's the government, and of course, we put that government there, apparently. We define employment as 1 hour of work per week. 1 hour of work per week. If you work for 1 hour a week, you are not entitled to receive benefits. So she doesn't have a brand. We can't see a brand there. But, you know, branding has moved on a little bit from the irons. And, you know, branding today looks something like this. You know, I'm not going to ask you to put your hand up. How many people slip that badge over their neck? Yeah. Forgive me for the people who might be wearing ties. Brian Gerrish. Brian and I have had this conversation, so. But I know why you do it. Yes, I know why you do it. But I will tell you why I will never, ever again wear a tie in my life, because I cannot for one moment comprehend why it is that a grown man willingly puts a noose around his neck every morning. But Brian does it so that he can converse with the other people who put nooses around their necks. I obviously can't, too. But yeah, this is the sort of branding that we see. And I must confess, this is a little tongue-in-cheek. And, of course, the wristband. But this is the modern-day branding. It's the ownership. It's the corporate ownership. And where's this going? Starts with the pets. And then, of course, we see this now going the stage further. This was in Wisconsin. And I believe that there is a company in Sweden now that is doing the same and actually incorporating, as Sweden rushes to go cashless, incorporating into the chip all your financial details. And therefore, you know, you don't need an Oyster card anymore. It's just whip your hand over the receptor at the gate. And so here it is. They're all waxing lyrical about the benefits of being chipped. Well, if you haven't seen this particular presentation from 2009, this is a gentleman by the name of Greg Nicoletos. And in 2009, Greg came to Bristol to speak at AV3. And the title of his talk was The Human Microchipping Agenda. And actually, the subtitle of his talk was First Your Pets, Then Your Kids, Then You. And if you take into account that presentation was almost exactly 9 years ago, just take a look at how prescient that presentation was. It's available to watch freely on the Alternative View YouTube channel. Now, Greg was also obviously clearly challenging the corporatocracy by being so prescient in his observation. And we had invited Greg to speak at AV5, I think it was. Was it 5? AV5. And you know, I'd been speaking to Greg, obviously, because I was bringing him over from Brisbane in Australia. And the game plan was that he was going to get to the UK a few days early to be able to sort of make the time adjustment. And that we'd booked him into the hotel from the Tuesday evening. And that was going to give him a couple of days. And he said, yeah, because then I can get my, you know, head clear and I can write my presentation. So imagine my surprise when I rocked up at the hotel to find that Greg hadn't arrived. And no word to me or to the hotel. And Greg eventually turned up quite late on the Friday, not in a good state. And it was very clear that there was something not right. And in fact, Paul, who's outside, I think Big Paul on the door there, I tasked Paul with staying very, very close to him and trying to make sure that, you know, nothing untoward occurred. Well, it became very clear that Greg was in no fit state to make his presentation on the Saturday evening when the schedule occurred. So we had to make some quick adjustment there. And on the Sunday morning, I got a phone call to my room saying, Mr. Crane, can you come to the golf course? We got an incident on the golf course. Well, unfortunately, it didn't take Sherlock to work out what the problem potentially was. And I got to the golf course and there was Greg being having been pepper sprayed, being pinned to the ground by some of the local constabulary. And Greg was arrested. Anyway, I quickly said to the arresting officer that he was on some very strong medication, which I didn't know for sure, but it was a guess. And I said, he should not be arrested as is. He should be arrested under the Mental Health Act. And the reason I was doing that was because it meant that he could not be interviewed without having a medical professional present. Well, the outcome of that was Greg was sectioned for 28 days. And because he had no family in the UK, then I was effectively sort of visiting him on a regular basis. And I was allowed to sit in on the interim hearing, which was after 14 days, when absolutely the right decision was made, which was that you know, he should be held for a further 14 days. And the reason that was the right decision was because had he been released at that point, he would have still been arrested by the police for the original offence. And I was still working with another lawyer to get that offence quashed. Well, what came out in that hearing was that Greg had to change planes in Dubai. And it was literally, well, he wasn't supposed to change planes. He was supposed to literally get off the plane while the plane was refueled and then fly on to London. But he didn't get back on that plane. But the plane left on time, which told me that somebody knew he was coming off the plane because his bag had to come off the plane. And it became apparent as Greg was put under questioning by the panel that effectively he'd been accosted in Dubai. He'd clearly been drugged and he'd effectively lost 3 days of his life. And then he'd been put back on a plane on the Friday to fly, or Thursday night, to fly to the UK. And then the first time I saw him was on the Friday evening. And it took a little while to piece together all of the bits of the jigsaw. And Greg, although he, you know, here we are 9 years later, and although he's made a very good recovery, he's still not the Greg Nicoletas that we saw at AV3 in 2008. And, you know, why? Because he was very much at the forefront. The reason I invited him to AV3 was because, in my opinion, at that time, he was the world's leading researcher in the microchipping agenda. And he was obviously getting a little bit too close to the truth. So, you know, we know what we're up against, but you know, we have to fight this. And what the establishment are scared shitless about is literally there being some kind of mass realization of what's occurring. And, you know, for all of us, you know, obviously we get advice and guidance about personal safety. And, you know, whilst I'm certainly not blasé about it, and none of us are blasé, but neither are we paranoid. And I know this is going to sound a bit glib, but you know, the bottom line for me is that part of our personal security is about maintaining a relatively high media profile in the alternative media. Because I work on the basis that, you know what, the establishment actually need to take pretty damn good care of me and Brian and Mike and Alex and Patrick. Because even if we have the most unfortunate accident, even if it is a genuine accident, there's going to be a hell of a lot of people that will never believe it was an accident. And then the Elvis effect kicks in. So we have to keep pushing. And the bottom line is that, you know, obviously what we do is just the thin end of a very, very fat wedge, because there's a massive community out there all challenging bits of the corporatist agenda. And, you know, this has really come to the fore in the last few years. And this is a classic example of the corporatocracy at work. This is Borkum in 2013. And basically the only way in which Quadrilla could get their trucks into the well site at Borkum was a massive police presence. And this was really the first indication to the British government and to the unconventional gas industry that actually, you know what, the British public were not just going to roll over. And this was a new type of activism, because this is community activism. No leaders, no NGO, although George Barda did try and actually get some corral around the Borkum event, but that didn't actually take off. And then as far as I'm concerned, Barda disappeared until he recently emerged as one of the leading lights in the Extinction Rebellion. Tells me all I need to know. But this is community activism. And what we've seen, and you've heard me talk about it before, you know, the Gerry activists in East Yorkshire, average age 72. A former NASA engineer, a former leader of Hull City Council, a number of teachers. The police didn't want them arrested. The gas company didn't want them arrested, because they knew that the negative media coverage would backfire. So what did they do? They went after some guy called Ian R. Crane. But that didn't work out too well for them either. So, you know, that's why now I am, I wouldn't say more than happy, but it's why I have absolutely no qualms about getting into the courtroom and meeting these head on. Because I have absolutely nothing to lose. Because the corporatist agenda works on the basis that it can keep you in line, because it's allowed you to taste the trappings of wealth, normally through a mortgage, the death grip. And it doesn't, you don't want to lose it. And if you've, you know, had the good fortune to be able to maintain your mortgage payments and actually own your house, or if you think you own your house, that's another story, but anyway, you own your house, then if you raise your head above the parapet, you know, the establishment will do everything it can to relieve you of that property, which is why what they're doing now is establishing, or trying to establish, a raft of supra-parliamentary legislation. And that's why I will be in court at the Rolls Building in Fetter Lane on the 11th, 12th and 13th. And what I guess are about to find out tomorrow is that this time I'm not going to be litigant in person, because I've actually found a barrister who thinks like we do. Hooray! So there's no possibility of this video getting out into the public domain before the court case, you see, so I can say that. Now, you know, this is going to be very, very interesting, because obviously there are court rules, and there are certain things that, as a member of the legal profession, you can't say. In other words, if the judge tells you he's not going to accept any that line of evidence, then basically there's not very much you can do unless you want to incur his wrath. And that's why acting as litigant in person is really, I mean, not something I would necessarily counsel unless you're you know, prepared for it. But the beauty is, as litigant in person, you can actually get away with a lot more than a member of the bar. So we have a little strategy where my barrister is going to present my case. And if the judge starts to shut him down on points where, which we want to get across, then I'm going to fire my barrister in the courtroom with his agreement, although we won't tell the judge that. We'll make a big deal about it, you know, and basically carry on. And then we have another case planned. The reason that we have to work like this is because I'm the only named defendant in this particular case. But we have another case that we're going to go take to full trial, where there's another named defendant. And what we're going to do in that is tag team, because my barrister is going to represent the other person and I'm going to be litigant in person. And so we get the best of both worlds. And, you know, the judiciary, of course, they don't like this. But, you know, more and more people are having to act as litigant in person because there's no such thing as legal aid anymore. And as people start to do their own research and they get creative as well because they're not bound by the rules of the bar or the law society. So they get creative, and it's amazing sometimes the results that you can get. It might not necessarily be the result you think you want, but nonetheless, it's a significant result in the wider scheme of things. And this is how we have to move forward here. Because, you know, fracking's been going around now for 6 years. So it is 6 years in 10 days, 11 days. It's 6 years in 11 days since the moratorium on fracking, unconventional gas exploitation, was lifted in this country. How many fracks have we had in the UK since that date? Well, as far as we know, one, maybe. What we've had is mini fracks, right, which have occurred by Quadrilla at Preston New Road since October the 15th. So here's the next question. How many earthquakes have been triggered by Quadrilla at Preston New Road since October the 15th? 36, yes. Unless there's any more since in the last day or so. But 36 seismic events. And, of course, 6 years ago, Quadrilla, along with all the other fracking companies, agreed to a traffic light system, which meant that if they triggered a seismic event that was greater than 0.5, they had to stop work immediately. Well, they haven't done any fracking for the last month, which is costing them about £94,000 a day in kit hire, which they're not using. And their partner company, which is actually owns about just under 50% of the stock, is an Australian company called AJ Lucas. And AJ Lucas let the cat out of the bag the other day because AJ Lucas let it be known that they and Quadrilla are lobbying the British government to raise the traffic light limits. This is the way the corporatocracy works. If you look, don't do it unless you really can't sleep. But I did a tour back in 2013 called Fractured Future. And the whole purpose of that tour was simply to get the word fracking into people's heads. It was to get it into their vocabulary. 63 events around the UK. And in that presentation, which is on YouTube, it's just called Fractured Future with a K. But in that, I made the observation. I said, this industry will do whatever it takes. It will say whatever it thinks it needs to say to get its foot in the door. And then it will just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. It's called mission creep. And this is a classic example of mission creep. So I put out a tweet, and which I then put on Facebook, that if Claire Perry relents and agrees to the limit being raised from 0.5, there has to be massive civil disobedience across the north of England. Which immediately got me banned from Twitter and Facebook. Well, if you think fracking was bad, then the next one, of course, is this. You know, Mark Steele is very much on point here. And, of course, I supported Mark Steele as his Mackenzie friend in both his civil case, where Gateshead Council tried to get an injunction against him. Once again, we had a packed public gallery and the judge. And I got to tell this story. Have I got time? I have to tell you this story. I have to tell the story because the judge initially hadn't come into court, but he was on the phone to the legal advisor. And so she's holding the phone like this, and she says, the judge says only six people are allowed in the public gallery. Mark, John was there. Only six people are allowed in the public gallery. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, that's absolutely ridiculous. I said, this is an issue of very significant public interest. And I said, and anyway, I said, everybody in the public gallery is going to behave themselves, aren't you? And you all went, yes. And she went, okay, all right, I'll tell them. She said, the judge says you can all come in. So we had a packed public gallery. And the judge, you know, starts off being sort of very pompous. But as the morning goes on, he realizes that Mark has got some very, very real issues. The science that Mark had included in his bundle was very, very different to the BS that was in the Gateshead Council bundle. And in fact, by mid-morning, the judge actually said, look, this was to the council representing, legal counsel, representing Gateshead Council. And he said, look, you know, before you go any further and waste our time, I am not minded to grant any injunction that prevents Mr. Steele from raising his concerns about this technology. He said, that's what you call democracy in action. To which the public gallery went, "Yay!" And he went, "Oh." And I have to say that Justice Nolan was brilliant. And you know what? This is something that we're starting to see, because there are other examples as well. But what we are starting to see is when the judges have a full public gallery, they are not insensitive to the views held by the people in the public gallery. And that's why it's so important. I know it's time-consuming and a lot of the cases are boring, but, you know, it's so important that when we have a challenge like this against the establishment, that whoever it is that's challenging them is well-supported. Now, so Mark got he got the injunction lifted, and in fact the judge basically instructed Gateshead Council to take his concerns seriously. And he said, "I'm not going to stop him from his democratic right to challenge. I'm just going to ask him to behave himself and not call people murderer or whatever." And, you know, of course, Mark is very much on the case. And this is the report I touched on earlier. This is the report that's been produced looking at the probable increase in suicides in Gateshead, which have been attributed to the possibility of finding themselves on universal credit. But in reality, as Mark has identified, and I discussed this with him on the last episode of Humanity vs. Insanity, where I had him on, we got a massive increase. This is not just Gateshead, by the way, but this is the increase in cancers. And, you know, as I said the other day, one person dies in this country every 4 minutes from cancer, with lung, breast, bowel and prostate cancers accounting 45% of that. So, you know, one person dies every 10 minutes from one of those cancers, which GCMAF could cure. And now, of course, Gateshead Council are looking to take advantage of that by establishing their own funeral business. So, the plantation mentality. The scriptwriter is a guy by the name of James Buchanan. He was a pariah in academia in the US, but he never let up from his focus on getting a return to what he calls liberty. Liberty in his vocabulary is the freedom of the corporatists to do what, that's the 5 minute warning, by the way, or 10 minute. The freedom to do whatever they want, to rape and pillage the planet and its population for profit, with absolute no regard for the impact or the morality. You know, and Buchanan saw the socialism, I'm not using that with a capital S, but the socialistic mentality emerge after the Second World War, you know, with the rise of the NHS and, you know, support of the unemployed, et cetera, et cetera. And for these sociopaths like Buchanan, that's anathema, because they are absolutely Malthusian in their philosophy, which is, if you are not making a direct contribution to the corporatocracy, if you're not on a payroll, then basically you are a complete waste of space. And as somebody said to me, you know, what we don't need in this country is a minister for suicide. What we need is the minister for fuck off and die, because that's the truth of the matter. That's what the establishment want. They don't want anyone who cannot make a contribution to the corporatocracy. And so what we are seeing is the eradication of the fundamentals of humanity, such as compassion. You know, and once a society loses its capacity for compassion, then, well, it's worse than the Wild West. It ain't even the law of the jungle. It's a lot worse, because their attitude is basically, let's just get out of my way. And there's no question in my mind that the reason that the corporatocracy don't want products like GCMAF to come to market, and, you know, why it is that they don't care about the suicides that are related to universal credit, because if somebody's on universal credit, then they're not making a contribution to the corporatocracy, because they're not on a payroll, so they might as well die. Why are our military suffering from phenomenal levels of PTSD? Of course, it's put down to battlefield experience. But let me tell you, some of it might be. But the vast majority of it isn't related to battlefield experience. It's related to the exposure to battlefield technology, of course, which is what this is based on. A battlefield technology, microwave technology, and it is the exposure to that battlefield technology that messes with the heads of our young servicemen and women. And when they come out of the services, because this is not even acknowledged as the cause, there is no treatment, no support, whatever. And of course, what we end up with is a phenomenal level of suicide. So, you know, the prognosis of doing nothing is actually pretty damn clear for me. And, you know, we can see already, this is the hall of shame. These companies employing people on 0 hours contracts. They're not interested in the health and well-being of those people on 0 hours contracts. They're only interested in maximizing the profitability by not having to pay people as employees, not having to pay national insurance, making sure they never get covered by the any employment protection legislation. It is rampant corporatocracy. And what we are facing is literally crimes against humanity. And the only way in which we can challenge this is get up close and personal. Now, that doesn't mean to say that everybody has to, you know, do what we're doing. If you can, that's fantastic. But it's what I said earlier. It's the pebbles. Pick up a handful of pebbles and throw them in that pond and create the ripples. Never underestimate the power of the pebble or the seed that you're sowing. And you never know where it's going to end up. Because that seed that I inadvertently sowed has had mixed reactions, of course. But, you know, it's had the benefit of curing many people from terminal illnesses. And it set in wheels a train which is well and truly rolling down the tracks. And now what we have to do is make sure that the establishment doesn't get what it wants, which is for David and Lynn and the others to disappear into obscurity, but that we take the opportunity to raise awareness of their plight and challenge the MHRA, because the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, are guilty of a crime, in this case against humanity, but actually there's many other crimes. So what I am doing with my barrister is we are looking at ways in which we can challenge the MHRA. Obviously, we'll lose. That's not the point. The point is that we take the opportunity to get it into court and raise the profile. And I'm not interested in a BBC audience. I'm interested in the audience that is capable of critical thought. So, now what I've established now is effectively a crowdfund to fight crimes against humanity. It's called Humanity Versus the Corporatocracy. My barrister is prepared to work for 10% of his usual fee. And only charge me a court day. So basically what he's doing is he's working on a no-win, no-fee basis. It's not quite no fee, obviously, because there's some covering expenses, because we know the outcome is like not going to necessarily work in our favor. But, you know, it's like this injunction that I'm challenging in the courts in a couple of weeks is the sixth injunction that I've challenged. Okay, I've had some quite significant successes, not least in getting protest pens thrown out at Preston New Road in March of last year. But, you know, it doesn't matter how many I lose, because every time I'm in court, I gain more experience, you know, and we find new arguments, we find new authorities. And let me tell you, we have some very, very interesting new material to bring to court when we're there on the 11th, 12th and 13th of December. So if you can be there, great. If you can't be there, then, you know, please consider making a contribution to the fund. The portals for that are on my two websites. It's the enrcrane.com and alternativeview.co.uk. And these funds will be used to support people who are challenging the corporatocracy head on. And not just to support them, but also to find ways in which we can continue their fight. And I know this fight isn't over. The injunction fight isn't over, because if we lose the injunction campaign, then what the corporatocracy have managed to achieve is getting the judiciary into their pocket where they can literally outlaw any form of effective protest. And you wouldn't believe the intellectual and legal agility that they present in trying to explain how that doesn't contravene Articles 10 and 11 of the Human Rights Act. Because for these guys, there is no such thing as a human right. And in fact, some of you may be aware that Jim Ratcliffe, the head of INEOS, Britain's wealthiest man, who lives in Monaco, and doesn't pay any tax in this country. But Britain's wealthiest man has claimed that his human right as the owner of INEOS is to be able to rape and pillage the planet and fleece his employees, which he's done. If you haven't seen or not aware of what Jim Ratcliffe did to the employees at Grangemouth in 2013, and then had the audacity to make a video bragging about how they destroyed the union and destroyed the final salary pension plan that they had in place. I mean, it's vomit inducing. But watch it, because that is the mentality that we're dealing with. But this is a winnable fight. You know, we've come a long, long way in a couple of decades. And this is going exponential. I mean, even probably, well, certainly 10 years ago, it was unthinkable that we could have held an event like this and had, whatever, 120, 130 people, or have AV conferences where we have nearly 300 people under the same roof, where people are coming together to develop their own strategies for challenging this. So, unfortunately, the prognosis is very clear. If we do nothing, we will be condemning future generations to lives of currently unimaginable abject misery. And the corporations don't give a stuff, because those who are at the head of those corporations don't consider those at the bottom end of the scale to be worthy of anything other than culling. And those in the middle who are perpetrating this agenda, they are effectively suppressing their own humanity for a salary check. So, does anybody think this is winnable? Yeah, I certainly do. I certainly do. So let's get after it. Let's grow this community, the alternative media community, support the people who are right at the front end of it, and help to bring about the changes that we all know we need to see. So thank you very much for joining me today. Thank you.